Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or a smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Radio Havana Cuba, and France 24. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan. The new South Korean president, Lee Jae-myung, is implementing a big shift in relations with North Korea, canceling loudspeaker propaganda broadcast at the border. U.S. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard visited Hiroshima and is speaking out for the abolishment of nuclear weapons. The Indian government is enticing foreign electric car manufacturers to create factories in the country. President Trump says the trade deal with China is done after tariff talks in London. NHK Japan.
South Korea's new president has signaled a shift from his predecessor on the government's stance towards North Korea. Lee Jae-myung did not mention the North during a ceremony to honor the war dead. Lee delivered a speech to mark Memorial Day at Seoul National Cemetery on Friday. Those commemorated include soldiers who died during the Korean War.
Building a peaceful country, free from the fear of war, a safe country where everyday life is stable, is the most responsible way to acknowledge their noble dedication and sacrifice.
The tone of his remarks contrasts with those of Lee's predecessor, Yoon Suk-yeol, who used the event to condemn the North's provocations and call for stronger security arrangements in his Memorial Day speeches. Lee said on the day of his inauguration he would open a communication channel with Pyongyang and establish peace on the Korean Peninsula through dialogue and cooperation.
South Korea's presidential office says the country's military suspended loudspeaker broadcasts against North Korea along the inter-Korean border on Wednesday. The South started the broadcast near the demilitarized zone last July to respond to the North's repeated launches across the border of trash-carrying balloons. The presidential office says the halt was ordered by President Lee Jae-myung. It says the measure reflects the government's commitment to restoring trust in inter-Korean relations and establishing peace on the Korean Peninsula. The Lee administration also asked private organizations to suspend their anti-Pyongyang leaflet campaigns. President Lee took office last week. In contrast to the previous administration, he's taking a conciliatory stance toward Pyongyang. Local media outlets report that South Korea is apparently trying to build an atmosphere that is conducive to holding talks with North Korea.
U.S. National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard has called for nuclear weapons to be abolished after visiting Hiroshima. It is rare for an active U.S. cabinet member to express such a position. Gabbard made the statement in a video message she posted on social media on Tuesday. She called her recent visit to the atomic-bombed Japanese city an experience that will stay with her forever. The director warned that the destructive power of today's nuclear weapons surpasses that of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki 80 years ago. Gabbard said a single nuclear weapon today could kill millions in just minutes. She added that radiation would subject survivors to lifelong suffering or death. Gabbard warned that the world is now closer to the brink of nuclear annihilation than ever before. She said politicians pushing for war are carelessly fomenting fear and tensions between nuclear powers.
So it's up to us, the people, to speak up and demand an end to this madness. We must reject this path to nuclear war and work toward a world where no one has to live in fear of a nuclear holocaust.
Now to the world's third largest auto market, India, where the government has unveiled a plan to woo foreign automakers to build electric vehicles there. It is offering to drastically cut import taxes for foreign automakers who pledge to set up EV factories in India. The deal is for makers who invest around $500 million or more in new plants. In return, they can import a limited number of EVs at a 15% rate for 5 years. Currently, tariffs are upwards of 70%. The plan was originally aimed at attracting Tesla. Prime Minister Narendra Modi held talks with its CEO, Elon Musk, earlier this year in Washington, but the EV giant isn't ready to bite. The government wants electric vehicles to make up 30% of domestic car sales by 2030. EVs accounted for just 2.5% of total car sales in fiscal year 2024.
And President Trump says a trade deal with China is done after top officials wrapped up 2 days of talks in London. The president notes that it's subject to final approval with his Chinese counterpart and himself. He says China will supply any necessary rare earths up front to the U.S. Trump says the agreement will also address the issue of accepting Chinese students to U.S. colleges and universities. The U.S. Treasury Secretary told lawmakers the talks were successful, but he urges Beijing to be what he called a reliable partner in trade negotiations.
If China will course correct by upholding its end of the initial trade agreement we outlined in Geneva, and I believe after our talks in London they will, then the rebalancing of the world's two largest economies is possible.
The discussions lasted late into the night on Tuesday. The two sides finally agreed on a framework for easing trade tensions, building on the consensus reached last month in Switzerland.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, France 24. Some press reviews on the U.S. protest against deportation, including the clearly marked Australian reporter being shot by police while on the air in Los Angeles. An excerpt from an interview with NYU professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat on who Stephen Miller is and his role in creating the crises over ICE and citizens protesting the arrest of undocumented Americans. An airport interview with Greta Thunberg, who was deported from Israel after being kidnapped by Israeli forces while attempting to bring aid to Gaza. An interview with Diva Aman, a marine biologist from UC Santa Barbara, at the UN Oceans Conference in France. She talks about the dangers of deep sea mining. France 24.
Now, this opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal here says that the deportation wars have begun. It argues this weekend's clashes could be a sign of what lies ahead. It says that the White House, though, has gone too far in trying to deport every single person who came to the U.S. Illegally, which amounts to millions of people with families, homes and jobs. The New York Times is also extremely critical of the situation. It said that Trump jumped at the chance of a standoff. It says that Trump is using the same playbook in LA that he used to, quote, punish universities, individuals and institutions that he views as political adversaries. Now, finally, The Guardian has this analysis piece today. They say that Trump's actions could be an attempt for him to deflect criticism on his political failures and instead blame a supposed enemy within.
you're talking about the LA protest, but you're focusing on the Australian press, yes?
Yeah, they're the ones who seem to be talking about it a lot, actually, Stuart. This is from the Herald Sun today, the conservative Murdoch-owned Melbourne-based paper, which, as you see there, says, "Hell reigns in the city of angels," of course, reporting that rubber bullets and tear gas were used to disperse protesters there who are protesting about a recent spate of ICE arrests. The reason the papers are also talking about it is, this is The Guardian Australia, by the way, which is headlining on this video that went viral of an Australian reporter, Lauren Tomasi, who works for Channel 9, who was basically shot with a rubber bullet yesterday in the middle of a live cross after a guard appeared to aim in her direction. Let's see if we can show you this video here. Hopefully the sound works. Take a look.
Moving them on through the heart of LA.
You just shot the
You can see the reporters there also getting caught up in the chaos. Channel 9 saying that the video serves as a stark reminder of the inherent dangers that journalists face, particularly when reporting in the field.
To New York, Ruth Ben-Ghiad is professor of history at New York University, author of the New York Times bestseller, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Thank you for speaking with us here on France 24. Based on the past, how would you characterize Stephen Miller? Is he the ideologue? Is he just a strategist? What role is he playing?
He's an ideologue. I do see him as an ideological fanatic. And he is in my book, which was written during the first Trump administration. He's very important as a kind of theorist of the idea of population engineering. Based on, you know, getting rid of immigrants. He's consistently echoed right-wing narratives of Putin and Orban and others in Europe. He's very connected to this kind of transnational community, seeing this as a crusade to save white Christian civilization. His grandparents were Holocaust survivors, but he has embraced the cause of white Christian civilization. And so he's been depicting these protests in Los Angeles as a kind of existential fight, and putting this thing that's so dangerous is he's talking about this, like, kind of trying to manufacture this crisis, which is a crisis of the whole nation, which pits an internal enemy, which are criminal illegal aliens, as he calls it, and Secretary of Defense Hegseth uses the same script, same words, and an external enemy. They're colluding with an external enemy, and that is foreign terrorists and drug cartels, this kind of transnational, shadowy criminal elements. And then he's inserting, this is the new and dangerous part, a third element, which is part of this, which is protesters, which were labeled by President Trump as insurrectionists. So once you start labeling domestic protesters, civilians, as part of this criminal mix, you're in you're in uncharted territory, and that is why there's this recourse to National Guard and active duty Marines.
And how much traction is he getting? We're speaking between the beginning of those riots in Los Angeles and next Saturday, where Donald Trump will be having a military parade on his birthday while there are no King's Day protests in many cities across the U.S.
Yes, and President Trump doesn't want his birthday parade marred by any protesters. So he's already announced that there'll be any protests will be met with heavy force. You know, many people see this as this whole thing as a kind of manufacturing a crisis to justify a kind of crackdown. And I see this as when we start to have federalized National Guards and an infantry battalion of Marines that has served in Iraq and Afghanistan. No wonder, as you said in your reportage, they're still training because they're not used to de-escalation. They're a battalion that fights enemies in the field. And so now they're supposed to be on the streets of Los Angeles. So this is obviously what some see as an authoritarian use of of the military, and that's why also it's getting so much attention.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, so many thanks for joining us from New York City.
Just going to cross now live to Charles de Gaulle Airport, where Greta Thunberg is speaking to reporters. Let's take a listen to what she has to say.
They did an illegal act by kidnapping us on international waters and against our will, bringing us to Israel, keeping us in the bottom of the boat, not letting us getting out and so on. But that is not the real story here. The real story is that there is a genocide going on in Gaza and a systematic starvation following the siege and blockade now, which is leading to food, medicine, water that are desperately needed to get into Gaza is prevented from doing so. But of course, there are many attempts like the like this mission, both by sea and land, to break that siege and open up a humanitarian corridor. This was a mission of trying to, once again, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition has been continuously sending boats aiming to break the siege and open up a humanitarian corridor since 2008. And this was one of those missions. And right now, more important than ever, because of the siege and because of the systematic starvation of over 2 million people and the full-blown live-stream genocide. And we cannot accept just seeing, witnessing all this and doing nothing. That can never be an option. I'm terrified at seeing how this extremely deadly passivity and silence is all over the world, leading to so many deaths. Our last boat that we were attempting to go on this mission with a month ago was a much larger boat with, of course, could fill much more aid. That was bombed twice, and all the evidence strongly points towards Israel. So we made this trip with a smaller boat and a smaller crew because that's all that we had, because they bombed the last boat. Well, I think the world needs a lot of more young, angry women, to be honest. Especially with everything going on right now. That's the thing we need most of. Of course, the aim was to get to Gaza and to be able to distribute the humanitarian aid. We were 12 peaceful volunteers sailing on a civilian ship carrying humanitarian aid on international waters. We did not break laws. We did nothing wrong. The point is that whatever the odds are, we have to keep trying because right now, when you look at the state of the world, everything feels meaningless. But unless you try to do everything you can, that's when we lose our hope, no?
Why do you think so many countries, governments around the world, are just ignoring what is happening in Gaza?
Because of racism. That's the simple answer, I would say. Racism and basically desperately trying to defend a destructive, deadly system that systematically puts short-term economic profit and to maximize geopolitical power over the well-being of humans and the planet. And right now it's very, very difficult to morally defend that. It is impossible, but still they are desperately trying, which is absurd is not the word, but there are no words to describe it.
The UN's Ocean Summit is continuing in the southern city of Nice. Over 90 countries are calling for a global treaty to restrict plastic pollution. Deep sea mining has also been in focus. And for more on this, we can go across to Antonio Carrigan, who's covering the event for us. Antonio, what's the latest?
Well, as we've discussed earlier in the week, deep sea mining is on the agenda. President Trump of the USA, he wants to plow ahead, bypass the seabed authorities and exploit the resources of the deep seas. Scientific criticism is loud and clear at this conference. I'm joined by Dr. Diva Amon. Dr. Amon, 66% of the world's oceans are deep seas. However, most of us know nothing about them. They are completely unknown to us. You're one of the only people in the world to have seen what those ecosystems look like. Paint us a picture.
It is like nothing you've ever experienced before. As you said, it's an enormous part of our planet, and that means it is home to hundreds of thousands of species, amazing biodiversity, everything from glowing sharks to blind white crabs that farm bacteria on their chest that they then eat to 1,000-year-old corals. This is really a special place. And as you've rightly said, it is extremely underexplored. A few weeks ago, a paper came out that said 0.001% of the deep sea floor globally is what has been seen. That's how little we know. And yet, we know this place is incredibly vulnerable. Those thousand-year-old corals, they do not deal well with impact, and that is why deep-sea mining has really been on topic here.
When we have heard Emmanuel Macron this week calling for further investigation into the deep seas, is that a gateway to exploitation down the line, or is that necessary? Do we know what the impacts could be of this deep-sea mining? Do we know enough already to call it quits, or is this further investigation a gateway to something dangerous?
That is a great question, and really, really a question that so many are trying to answer. In my opinion, as a deep sea scientist, we absolutely know enough to know that this is not necessarily a good idea with the currently proposed technology and on the scale currently being proposed. This would not be a small-scale venture if deep-sea mining moves forward. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of square kilometers of the world's ocean, essentially where there would be irreversible damage in a lot of it. Those ecosystems will never recover, not on our generation timescales, not our children's generations. This is million-year timescales. So really, there is a lot more work to do around can deep-sea mining ever take place in a way that wouldn't harm the environment. Many of us are doubtful. But we do need to do more science to be able to say whether that is the case or not. But in my opinion, we also know enough to know that, hey, these are very special places and we should be going forward with absolute care, because if we break it, it is highly unlikely we will be able to fix it.
As you say, we know very little about the deep seas. Do they know about us? Have they already experienced the impact of human activity?
I love that. Yes. So that is, again, a great question. Often I've explored deep seas all around the world, and often we are going to places where no one has ever been before. We get down there, and what do we find? Our trash. We find the marks of fishing trawls. There is no place on the planet where we have not touched and made an impact. And the deep sea, while it is out of sight, while it is out of mind, it is absolutely not out of our reach. Currently, there's climate change, pollution, fishing, and now with other potential extremely damaging industries on the horizon like mining, really we need to be turning our sights to the deep ocean to understand it more, know it more, value it more.
What do you say to those who say deep sea mining is a way of accessing those precious metals that are going to be essential to the green transition?
So, I mean, that is the main narrative we hear from mining proponents. But that energy transition, trying to solve the climate crisis by getting minerals from the deep sea, by undertaking deep sea mining, is like smoking to lower stress. We know the ocean is our greatest ally in the fight against climate change. It sequesters huge amounts of carbon. It absorbs enormous amounts of heat. And if deep sea mining moves forward on the scale upon which it is proposed, we know that that function, that service which it provides, which keeps the planet habitable, it may be irreparably damaged.
24 countries have called for a moratorium.
37.
We've moved up. Excuse me. Is that enough?
So yesterday, I think the day before at UNOC, we saw four more countries join this call for a moratorium or pause, bringing the total to 37. That is not yet enough, but the first call came at UNOC 2 in Lisbon just 3 years ago, and in that 3 years, we have seen that number exponentially increase. So we are absolutely on the right track to protecting the deep sea, and we just need some more time to be able to, again, understand it better and value it.
On the right track, that's good to hear. Thank you very much, Dr. Raymond. Back to you in the studio.
Those press reviews and reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English and most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this program, like a subscriber from Central California did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show on the airwaves. Please, help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. 300,000 Italians demonstrated against a war in Gaza last weekend in Rome. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators have marched through the streets of the Italian capital, Rome, against the war in Gaza in a protest called by Italy's main opposition parties, who accuse the right-wing government in Italy of being too silent. At the start of the rally over the weekend, protesters held a banner reading, "Stop the massacre, stop complicity." The protest attracted a diverse crowd from across the country, including many families with children. According to organizers in Italy, up to 300,000 took part in the rally organized by the opposition to ask the government for a clear position on the conflict in Gaza. This is an enormous popular response to say enough to the massacre of Palestinians and crimes of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government. The leader of Italy's center-left Democratic Party, Elie Schein, told reporters at the march, "There is another Italy that does not remain silent as the Meloni government does." And she said, referring to Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, "Meloni was recently pushed by the opposition to publicly condemn Netanyahu's offensive in Gaza, but many observers considered her criticism too timid." Earlier this week, the Italian leader urged Italy to immediately halt its military campaign in Gaza, saying its attacks had grown disproportionately and should be brought to an end to protect civilians. Israel faces mounting international criticism for its offensive and pressure to let aid into Gaza during a humanitarian crisis where people are suffering from famine. Gaza has been under an Israeli blockade for nearly 3 months, experts warning that many of the 2,100,000 residents are at a high risk of famine. Israel's war on Gaza has killed at least 54,700 Palestinians, almost 55,000, mostly women and children, over the past several months. The Italian demonstration, bringing out 300,000 people to the streets of the Italian capital in support of the Palestinian people and in opposition to the Italian government's complicity and silence in the face of genocide.
That report was from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website works well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you could stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can always listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. Since I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.